We take a look now at a period of church history I think has much to say to something that's going on in many churches across the United States today. More of that later in the episode. For the church in the West, the 14th century opened on what seemed a strong note. Early in 1300, Pope Boniface VIII proclaimed a year of Jubilee, a new event on the church calendar. The Pope's decree announced a blanket pardon for all sins for all who visited the churches of Saints Peter and Paul in Rome over the following 10 months. And as we'd expect, huge crowds poured into the city. Boniface VIII was interesting. He had a flair for the pomp and circumstance of pretentious ceremony. He regularly appeared in public dressed in royal, or better to say, imperial robes, announcing, "I am Caesar, I am emperor." His papal crown had 48 rubies, 72 sapphires, 45 emeralds, and 66 large pearls. He could afford to be generous with pardons. At the Church of St. Paul, pilgrims to Rome kept priests busy night and day collecting and counting the unending offerings. For Boniface, looking ahead, the years seemed bright. The Vatican had held unrivaled religious and political power for two centuries, and nothing on the horizon portended change. The Pope had before him the sparkling example of Innocent III, who 100 years before had dominated emperors and kings. Boniface assumed that he'd carry on in the same vein. But just 3 years later, Boniface died of shock at the greatest personal insult ever inflicted on a pope. Even as the Jubilee celebrants rejoiced, forces were at work to end the hegemony of the medieval papal sovereignty. You don't have to study history long before you discover there are often major changes brewing beneath the surface, long before people are even aware of them. The 14th century was such a time. The Roman popes continued on in a business-as-usual mode while radical new ideas and forces were altering European politics. The idea of Christendom, that is, of a Christian empire unifying Europe from the 6th through the 14th centuries, was rapidly deteriorating. So-called Christendom had been useful in creating a semblance of unity in 7th and 8th century Europe, when that rigid tribalism of the past meant incessant war. But its importance faded in the 12th and 13th, when that unity began to fracture once more under the emerging power of greedy royals. Pope Innocent III had indeed demonstrated that papal sovereignty was effective in rallying princes for a crusade or for defending the church against heretics. But the 14th and 15th centuries saw a marked decline in papal power and prestige as that of kings rose. Because we are used to thinking of the world politically, that is, as a collection of nation-states, it's difficult to get our heads around the idea that those nation-states are a rather recent phenomenon. For most of history, people lived regionally. Their lives and thoughts were circumscribed by the borders of their, well, county or village. For centuries, Gauls and Goths defined themselves by their tribe. It never occurred to them to call themselves French or German. Such national labels don't come into play until late, as Europe emerged from the Middle Ages into what we call the modern world. A world, by the way, marked as modern precisely because of this new way of identifying ourselves. By the 14th century, people were just beginning to get used to the idea that they were English or French. This was possible because of, for the first time, they began to think of the political state in terms that was independent of their religious affiliation. Europe was moving ever so slowly away from its feudal past. Land was less important as hard cash became the new emphasis. Those at the political top came to realize that they needed ever larger sources of revenue, which meant taxes. Edward I of England and Philip IV of France, also known as Philip the Fair, were, as was typical in previous centuries, at odds with each other. And to finance their increasingly expensive campaigns of territorial expansion, they decided to tax the clergy. But popes had long maintained that the church was exempt from such taxation, especially if the money raised was being used to let some other guy's blood out of his body at high speed. In 1296, Pope Boniface VIII issued a decree threatening excommunication for any ruler who taxed the clergy and any clergy who paid without the pope's consent. But Edward and Philip were of the new kind of monarch advancing to Europe's many thrones. They were unimpressed by Rome's threats. Edward warned that if the church didn't pay, the crown's protection of the church would be removed, with their property seized in lieu of taxes. Philip's answer was to block the export of gold, silver, and jewels from France, depriving Rome of a major source of revenue from its collections there. So Pope Boniface backed down, protesting that he'd been misunderstood. He certainly had not meant to cut off contributions for the defense of the realm in times of need. It was a clear victory for both of the kings. Now, their victory over papal power had a way yet to go. Reinforced by the success of the Jubilee, Pope Boniface assumed that reverence shown him in every corner of Europe extended to the civil sphere as well. He had another gold ornament added to his crown, signifying his temporal power. And then he went after France's King Philip, trying to undermine his right to rule. Philip responded by challenging the Pope to show where Jesus gave the church temporal authority. In 1301, Philip imprisoned a French bishop on a charge of treason. Boniface ordered his release and rescinded his earlier concession on taxation of church lands. The next year, Philip summoned the French nobility, the clergy, and other leaders and formed a kind of French parliament. He then gained their unanimous support in his quarrel with the Pope. One of the new civil ministers put the choice that they had to make this way, quote, "My master's sword is made of steel, the Pope's is made of words," unquote. Now, several months later, Boniface issued the most extreme assertion of papal power in church history, a papal bull that was known as the Unum Sanctum, which means the Holy One, most famous of all bulls of the Middle Ages. It asserted the Pope's authority over all other authorities. His meaning was unmistakable. He declared, quote, "It's altogether necessary for every human being to be subject to the Roman pontiff," unquote. Philip's counter to the Unum Sanctum was no less drastic. He moved to have Boniface deposed on the grounds that his election by the cardinals had been illegal. And to carry out his plan, King Philip turned to William of Nogaret, the lawyer helping him set up the political foundations of France. Nogaret was a master at producing so-called evidence. He gained testimony to support his case by such dubious means as stripping a witness, smearing him with honey, and then hanging him near a beehive. His case against Boniface went way beyond the charge that his election was illegitimate. Nogaret claimed that the Pope was guilty of heresy, simony, and gross immorality. Given authority by a French assembly of clergy and nobles, he rushed to Italy to bring the Pope to France for trial before a church council. Boniface was 86 and had left Rome for the summer. He was staying in his hometown when Nogaret arrived with troops. They broke into Boniface's bedroom, violently manhandling him. They waited a few days for him to recover and then prepared to return to France, but the people of the town discovered what was happening and they rescued the Pope. He died just a few weeks later, thoroughly humiliated. Now, this tragic affair becomes a marker, a turning point in how popes and princes related to one another. Europe's rulers would no longer tolerate papal interference in what they regarded as political matters. The problem was, after so many centuries of Christendom, it was difficult sorting out where politics ended and church affairs began. What was clear was that a king's power within his own country was now a fact. At the same time, abuse of a pope, even an unpopular one, is deeply resented by the common people. Despite his declaration of the Jubilee, Boniface was not a beloved leader. He'd been a target of much criticism. To give you an idea of just how low Boniface's esteem had fallen, Dante, the author of the Inferno, reserved a special place in hell for him, the eighth circle of hell. That's where Boniface is to be found in the book. It's just one ring above the lowest circle. Still, the Pope was regarded as the vicar of Christ, and few people at that time could conceive of Christianity without the Pope and the religious hierarchy that he presided over. Even when there was no political vocabulary for it, people of the early 14th century began to distinguish between secular and religious authority and recognize the rights of each in its own place. When Boniface's successor died after just a brief reign, Philip's daring coup bore its inevitable fruit. In 1305, the College of Cardinals elected a Frenchman, the Archbishop of Bordeaux, as Pope Clement V. Clement never set foot in Rome, preferring to stay closer to home, where he was always accessible to do the French royal bidding. Clement's election marked the start of a 72-year-long period called the Babylonian Captivity of the Papacy, named after the Jewish exile some 2,000 years before. Following Clement, six popes, all of them French, ruled from the French town of Avignon rather than Rome. Now, this relocation of the popes to France, it was more than a matter of geography. In the thinking of Europeans, the eternal city of Rome stood not only for the idea of the apostolic succession of the church founded by St. Peter, but also of Roman imperium. Avignon was surrounded by what? The French kingdom. It seemed to the rest of Europe that the church had become a mere tool in the hands of the French throne. This was resented bitterly in Germany. In 1324, Emperor Louis the Bavarian moved against the French Pope John the 22nd by calling for a general council on the lines of the great church councils of the past that had been called for dealing with just such crises. Among the scholars supporting the call for a council was Marsilius of Padua, who'd fled the University of Paris. Now, in 1326, Marsilius and his colleague, John of Yondun, presented Emperor Louis with a work titled Defender of the Peace. This questioned the entire papal structure of the church and called for a democratic government. Defender of the Peace asserted that the church was the community of all believers and that the priesthood was not superior to the laity. Neither popes, bishops, nor priests had any special function. They served only as agents of the community of believers. Now, in this revolutionary view of the church, the pope was made over into just an executive office of the church council, which were simply spiritual elders. The pope was subordinated to the authority of the council. This new church government form was called conciliarism, and it would soon move from theory into practice. Now, as I mentioned at the outset of this episode, what we've looked at here speaks, I think, with special relevance to something that's happening in not a few churches across the United States right now. It's a highly polarizing movement that's called Christian nationalism. Let's see what light the development in the European church of the 14th century can shed on the American church of the 21st. Christendom is a word that many have heard of but have little idea what it means. They suppose it's equivalent to Christianity, the entirety of all those who call themselves Christians. That's not Christendom, at least not as originally conceived in the minds of European Christians in the Middle Ages. Maybe the best way to understand what Christendom is to take a closer look at the word itself. It's a merging of the words Christian and kingdom. The idea of Christendom arose in Europe during what's called the Dark Ages. The fall of Rome in the West left the continent reeling. Many people longed for a return to the days when there was a central government to provide a measure of political and economic security. And the result was the emergence of the Holy Roman Empire, a complex and diverse political entity that took shape in Europe and operated in one form or another for about 1,000 years. It was a loose collection of territories and principalities governed by an elected emperor. The origins of the Holy Roman Empire lie in the year 800, when Charlemagne was crowned by Pope Leo III as the first Holy Roman Emperor. Charlemagne's empire was vast, stretching from modern-day France to Germany and Italy. His coronation was hoped by many as a revival of the ancient Roman Empire, but this time in league with the Roman Church. The hope was to unite the continent under a political system that was an expression of Christian values and virtues. The emperor was regarded as God's representative on earth, responsible for protecting and promoting the Christian faith, which at that time was synonymous with the interests of the Roman Church. And that meant its hierarchy, that it's the popes and the cardinals and the bishops. The church was so wed to the politics of Europe that as the continent began to break into the regions that would eventually become the modern nation states that we know of today, the popes, who'd once exercised dominance over rulers, began to be their pawns, as we just saw when the King of France managed to relocate the papacy to France. For the next 7 decades, popes were puppets of the French throne. The buddy system between church and state that was de rigueur for the Holy Roman Empire had long seen the corruption of the church's God-ordained and Christ-initiated mission, long before the French king co-opted the church. Church leaders had filled the roles of political operators. It was all part of European feudalism. Christendom is a merging of church and state. It didn't work then, and it won't work now, though a new generation of Christians are calling for it. It goes under the banner of Christian nationalism. It's an attempt to revive Christendom. Though the Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages was a colossal failure, those urging the cause of Christian nationalism think they'll get it right this time. The arrogance and chronological snobbery of the present strikes yet again. While the roots of Christian nationalism go back a ways, the movement got a boost from COVID. Government lockdowns and restrictions on personal liberties enraged many. It seemed a prime example of bureaucratic overreach and a far cry from the limited government envisioned by the founders. Some pastors and Christian leaders leveraged the moment to rally behind a call for resistance to the tyranny of power-hungry bureaucrats. That woke up churchgoers who before had been disinterested in politics. The idea that the government could close their church caused outrage. It sounded like something straight out of the Soviet Union. Overnight, people who before had sat quietly in church were now speaking out, and they were speaking out loudly. Motivated by pastors urging political engagement, they took in a heavy dose of teaching about the linkage between Christianity and American history. They began to regard America as unique among the nations, a land of special promise and mission. The average person in the pew didn't realize that, quite frankly, they were being groomed to be the shock troops of Christian nationalism. What today is referred to by both adherents and opponents as Christian nationalism is really just a reheated version of medieval Christendom. It didn't work then. It won't work now. It can't, because it naively ignores the truism that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The power of the gospel is to save the lost, not the state. The God-ordained mission of the church is not to redeem the institutions of society. It's to preach the gospel and make disciples. As the church remains faithful to that, lives are changed, and those changed lives will change society. But the moment the church shifts its focus onto societal change itself, it fails. Peter tried to help Jesus start his earthly reign by swinging a sword, the symbol of civil authority and power. Jesus rebuked him, because that's not how the kingdom of God is manifest, for now. The day is coming when Jesus will come with a sword, but it's not today. There is no place now for modern Christendom. That awaits Jesus' return.